and Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, this summer, as in so many other summers in the past, in small communities, different kinds of places, different places around the country, an age-old battle is playing out. It is the battle between the townies and the tourists. And in some cases, it's a slightly different kind of battle, the battle between the townies and the summer people, a battle that can be, well, even more intense is that between the townies and the tourists. This morning on Focus 580, we'll be talking with the author of a recently published comic novel that sets this battle on the northern coast of Lake Michigan. The book is The Lake, the River, and the Other Lake. It is published by Pantheon Books, and it's been written by our guest, Steve Amick. He is a short fiction writer, and until now, the work that he's done that's been published has all been short stories, and his work has appeared in McSweeney's, The Southern Review, The New England Review, Playboy Story, the anthology The Sound of Writing, also on National Public Radio. He has an MFA from George Mason University. He's been a college instructor, a playwright, a copywriter, a songwriter, and musician. He makes his home in Michigan, dividing his time between his hometown, which is Ann Arbor, and a family cottage that's located along the northern edge of the Lower Peninsula. The book is just out now, fairly recently, and it's been getting a lot of positive attention. As I said, it's published by Pantheon, so if you'd like to read the book, you can head out to the bookstore and take a look at it. Of course, here this morning on the program, if you have questions you'd like to call in, talk with our guest, you can certainly do that as well. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, that's 800-222-9455. So again, 333-WIL. Or 9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Steve Amick, hello.
David.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited about this. I've been listening to you online long distance and I really enjoyed the show.
Well, thanks very much. I don't think that guests, prospective guests, do that very often, checking me out. In fact, it makes me feel uneasy, the very idea that they might do that. So,
well, I feel a little uneasy about the hour, and I have to warn you ahead of time that I'm one of those horrible night owl writers. So if I'm fuzzy-headed or my sentences are flipped around, it's just that. It's getting worse because of all the stuff that's going on with the tour and a lot trying to keep up and finish a second book, etc. So I hope I don't sound like a dolt.
Oh, I'm sure you won't. Believe me, I have had some dolts on the program, and I'm sure you won't. Well, and I hope you're not getting tired already about talking about the book, because we talk with a lot of authors on the show, and sometimes people are on these really long tours, and I wonder, how many interviews have they done by the time that they talk to me, and are they just sick to death about talking about it at that point, or can they still maintain some shred of excitement about the project when they're doing their 30th or 40th interview?
Well, it's interesting to me. I've read the book now in so many different ways through the editing process that my sense of it is very different than everyone else's now. And so it's interesting to hear the questions, and usually there's something I didn't expect and makes me think about it again and sort of look back at the book in a different way. So it's interesting to me.
Yeah.
There's always something that I didn't see coming at all.
Well, I guess maybe we should talk a little bit about the lay of the land right at the beginning.
Right.
And you have created a very detailed fictional community here. In fact, the jacket of the book is a hand-drawn map of the place, which is really fairly realized in some fair amount of detail. So obviously you've thought a lot about this place and have a sense of what kind of place this is, and that is indeed one of the things that I think the book is about. It's really about sense of place, and it's about, I know you have said that in one of the quotes here I have, that you really feel this, that it partly is in large part about this connection between people and the place they live and how it is that the place they live ends up determining what kind of people they are.
Yeah, even within a community, the place they live. If you live on the lake, if you live on Lake Michigan in this case, versus on the river, if you live on one side of the little inner lake, even on the Indian side versus the other side, that gives the person a sense of who they are, and it gives other people a sense of who they are. And sometimes they're in conflict. A lot of people are walking around thinking they're a local when they're not. So that's interesting to me, just in that, even within that town. I mean, we think of sense of place as, he's from this town or that town, but even within that little microcosm, you get a lot of kind of jingoistic attitudes.
Sure. Well, the town is called Winishkeen, and I'm assuming that I'm coming close to the... My Ojibwe is not so good, so I'm coming close to the right kind of pronunciation.
Well, I'm not a native speaker either, but yeah, it's close. I say Winishkeen.
Ah.
But you haven't slaughtered it as badly as some.
And of course, there is a story associated with this name, which you tell early in the book, that apparently it's close to the Ojibwe phrase that asks the question, who are you, which gets back to that issue that we were talking about before. Maybe you can tell the story of how Winishkeen comes to be named Winishkeen.
Yeah, there's a little historical preamble that goes back several hundred years to the first European who is sort of a runaway translator, polyglot Greek from the French explorers. And he comes on shore there, and he's asking in a variety of languages, where am I? And the Ojibwes, or Chippewa, or Anishinaabe, whatever you want to call them, are saying to him, Winishkeen, which means, who are you? And he takes this back to the French and describes this town called Winishkeen. And I was kind of just playing with a story, like an origin story, where there was a misunderstanding, and the words I found that worked nicely were those. It seemed like a logical thing that they would ask him, you know, the first white man they ever saw, who are you? So it's sort of one of those happy accidents that happens in fiction when it's really happening in an amorphous way, where you're not planning everything according to symbols and stuff, but you discover the topics, you discover these happy accidents, and this issue of identity, which was already there in the stories, then became more pronounced to me, and I realized that's kind of what this is about. So that had to really be there in the beginning, that the whole town is based on this false sense of identity.
Mm-hmm. The lake, the river, and the other lake, the first lake in the title is Lake Michigan.
Right.
And the river is a river that then connects Lake Michigan with this other lake, Lake Minnegeesis.
Right.
Which is a lake around which people have built cottages. There are some people who have houses there who have lived there for a long time, or those houses have been there for a long time. And then it's also a place where some wealthy people have come in and built something you say that they might call cottages that maybe would be a lot more than just a cottage where people would go and spend the summer. And as you suggested before, there is one side of the lake that's kind of the ritzy side, because that's where the wealthier people have built these newer houses, and the other side of the lake that is more the locals or the townies or the people have been there for a long time. And that sets up this one of these many kind of stratifications in Winishkeen society between the newer people and the older people, and between the people who have a lot of money and the people who don't have much money. And even among the wealthy people, there are even gradations among them in terms of how much money you have. And there are people who have a lot more than others, even though the locals probably see all those kinds of people as kind of being all the same.
Yeah, only within the lake would you probably see the difference. And because most true locals probably have been squeezed out because the taxes are so high, but you're right. There is the difference of sort of middle income versus almost celebrity rich people.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing there too, again, is that the nice the wealthiest side is called the Indian side, which at one time, at the turn of the century, was the, you know, the wrong side of the tracks. and the less expensive side is the nice side.
Mm-hmm.
Because of constantly shifting. There was, you know, it was cheaper land. It was the only thing left for a while. You buy there, you smash down the shacks, and you build this giant monstrosity. And you see that more and more in a lot of resort communities, this sort of end of the true cottage, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that I guess in an urban setting, one might call that gentrification.
Yeah.
Maybe that's you'd use the same term in a place like this. But as you say, I'm sure that there's lots and lots of places around the Great Lakes and probably on the Pacific Coast, and I'm sure in places like coastal Maine where the same kind of things are going on.
Well, that's what's really been interesting about the book. When I was writing it, first of all, it was one of those things that seemed such a personal amusement that I was thinking, who's even going to read this? And then it went to, well, maybe it's a regional publication kind of thing. And then, you know, it's Pantheon, which is, you know, the height of literature and everything. And their reaction, the reaction in those places you talk about was really surprising. Was one of the first things that happened before the book actually came out with booksellers is they were getting responses from you know, Northern California communities and Florida and Maine, and I think it appeals to anybody who's from a place that has some seasonal based economy, and yeah, that could even be winter, you know, that could be a ski area. This idea where the society and the town is really kind of relies on these people that they resent.
And I think it's interesting that suggests that you could, as a reader, one could come to the book in two different ways, that one could come to it in a sense that you think that it's kind of quaint because it's nothing like the way that you live, or on the other hand, you could come to the book and somehow identify with it because you either have been to a place like that, or maybe you grew up in a place like that, or spent some time in a place like that, and you can relate to it on that level that says, yeah, this actually feels kind of real to me. I recognize Wineshkin, and I recognize these people because I've known people just like them.
Sure. The funny thing is that when some of the people in New York were saying, wow, the details are so exotic, and to me I was thinking, wow, this is just so pedestrian. I mean, in the winter, you know, in the spring, they put out their docks, and the people come to town and they buy fudge. The details are perhaps, you know, exotic to somebody from Texas, but the dynamic is pretty universal.
Yeah, I know you had a chance to chat a little bit with one of my producers. She grew up in Petoskey, so she's given it her thumbs up for authenticity. I think she says, yes, I recognize this place, and I recognize some of these kinds of people.
Yeah, it's doing really well up there. I noticed. I heard a great story from a bookseller in Petoskey about someone came in looking for it and said that she was a summer person that, you know, was doing her laundry at the laundromat, and there was another cottage person there sitting on a dryer or something and laughing. And she finally went over and asked, "What are you reading?" And so I love the idea that it was discovered by somebody in a laundromat, which I think is one of the things that is possibly dying off because of these bigger house cottages, that it's the end of the laundromat. It's the end of the reason for the person who's there for more than a weekend or a week to come to town because they have all the luxuries of home. But Petoskey is very, Petoskey's mentioned in the book in a couple places, but it's very familiar to this type of a town.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Steve Amick, and we are talking about his newly published novel, The Lake, the River, and the Other Lake. And it is indeed published by Pantheon. His short fiction has appeared in a number of different places. This is his first novel. He makes his home in Michigan, and he is also a musician as well as being a writer. And there's a CD that has some material on it that thematically is linked with some of the things that are in the book. At some point here, I thought maybe we'd play something we could play from the Lake, the River, and the Other Lake jukebox sampler, which is, I guess, a collection of things that have been previously released on other CDs.
Yeah. Anyway. A lot of Michigan songwriters, including myself. And it's also fun. You can check that out online, too, on this Pantheon. There's a couple websites, but Pantheon made this website of my map that you mentioned earlier that I believe they're about to launch a contest with a scavenger hunt. And you go around and you look at the map and you figure out little trivia questions about the map. And but it's this great flash site. I don't know if you had a chance to see it.
In fact, I have it up on the computer right in front of me right now, and
yeah,
it is very nice.
They spent a lot of time on that, and I was really impressed with it. A lot of the photos are photos I gave them from my family, so we could get free access, you know, free use of the photos. But it's sort of a conglomerate. You get to see photos and Michigan places that are supposedly Winnetkin and recipes and things. But there is a jukebox that you can go to, and you can hear some of this stuff.
It's one of the most real fictional places I think I've seen in some time. I have to ask now, just because I'm up in this one particular part of the map, one of the stories that is told in the book is about a lighthouse, a place called Sumac Point. And in the book, it explains that at one point, as a kind of an alternative to the actually having a light in the lighthouse, they painted the lighthouse with radium so it would glow in the dark. And of course, it was kind of bad for the lighthouse. It caused it to crumble. But now,
and probably bad for the lake.
I would think, and anybody who happened to be, you know, happened to be close, yeah. I just have to ask you never heard of such a thing happening. You did make this up, didn't you?
No, in fact, I remember the moment of making it up and standing up from the table and kind of, you know, when I finished writing it, kind of chuckling like, you know, what the heck was that? But, you know, it's the Army Corps of Engineers, so it's totally believable that they would do that. It was just a lark, that was pure imagination, without any plot intent. And later on, it comes into play in the book as a crucial part of the plot. Which, if you read it, you probably would think that I had the second appearance of the lighthouse and its crucial plot point first, and then came up with the reason for it to be in this state. But I actually came up with this as just a whim of detail that I thought would make the town kind of unique and have a nice focal point they could put on postcards, but would be sort of corroded and you know, deteriorated and not right, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was just a whim, but later it became sort of like that gun that has to go off, you know. So it does it does make another appearance.
The book is very much a set of stories about individual characters. It's really an ensemble kind of a cast, although there is one particular character that does, in reading it, and I think in the way people have reacted to the book, one particular character that's...
I know who it is.
Exactly. That seems to kind of come to the front. And we'll talk about Roger in a second here. But I'm interested in how you approach the writing of it, having been somebody who pretty much worked in the story form before. Is that the way that you thought about it, as kind of a collection of stories about a number of different people, but all the thing that links them really is the place, the fact that they all live in this community and, in a sense, share in the same sort of stresses and strains and concerns and conflicts that you would find in a community that has these kinds of features that we've talked about?
Yeah, I first of all, I never intended it to be short stories and then changed my mind. I always saw it as a novel, but I did deliberately set out to write it that way because I was having more and more success selling stories, and I was feeling more confident with that form. They were getting longer and more detailed and more novelistic, in terms of the topic, I'd always sort of disregarded Michigan. I grew up here, and then I went away. I lived in many places, New York and L.A. and D.C. And I always, when I was younger, I thought of it sort of as a pedestrian kind of backdrop for a story. But when I moved back here about 7 years ago, I started creeping in. And I had the general idea of, what about that? I mean, the summer up north is such an important time in my life, all my life. And what if I don't really drive the story with any preconceived idea, but write it from different parts of the town and just let those characters kind of take on their own storyline? So I did write it that way. I wrote it as individual, you know, computer files, a different folder for each story, knowing that I would then shuffle them together and write interstitial pieces that would connect them, and that the characters would appear in each other's storylines. But it was never, it's always individual storylines, but never with the intent of them being separate short stories. And I think I succeeded in covering up my tracks, because my editor didn't know that when I told her recently that that's how I wrote it originally. She was surprised.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it works as a novel, but it was an attempt for me to figure out what are my strong suits and how can I, you know, because I've attempted novels for years and I've written a bunch that are just sitting in drawers, and so I thought I'd try it this way.
Yeah, well, I think it is kind of interesting. I'm sure that there are different ways to write novels, and I'm sure I wouldn't really know how to do one if I decided that I was going to do it, but that we do see now. There are a number of novels that have come out recently that seem to be kind of constructed like this, in these kind of that either they're novels that really are a novel in stories, or that they are semi-discrete pieces that are linked by theme and character.
Right.
And I'm not necessarily saying that, you know, one way or another constructing a narrative is better, or I think it's just different, and, you know, depends upon the writer and what he or she, you know, what their inclination is and what works for them. It just seems to me that we're starting to see maybe a few more novels like this. Or maybe it's just that novels, they're getting attention, and for good reason, because they're good. And that's just one of the features of the writers and how they do what they do.
Well, the one I remember that I had in mind, I think, when I first just thought, oh, I could do this, and maybe I'm wrong in remembering it this way, but what I was remembering was To Have and Have Not.
Hmm.
And I believe that's written that way about disparate characters in Cuba. And I think that was kind of what I was thinking about. If I remember right, the book is nothing like the movie. First of all, it's not even in Cuba. But I think that Hemingway, that one is that way.
Huh.
So we've seen in the... Oh, and I think Cannery Row is like that. We've seen it a little bit, but yeah, I think there might be a trend right now.
Hmm. Well, it's very entertaining. The lake, the river, and the other lake. People who are listening this morning, I recommend it. If you're looking for something that's somehow particularly summery, I kind of like that too. Maybe that's, you know, at certain times of the year, either when it's really hot, maybe you want to read something summery, or maybe that's when you want to read the book that's set in Alaska. I don't know. It sort of depends on what your inclination is. But the book is just out now, The Lake, the River, and the Other Lake, by our guest, Steve Amick, and it's published by Pantheon.
I've had a couple people tell me that they read it early on in May, and they were sort of kicking themselves because they felt like they really wished they'd enjoyed it in the summer. They felt so summery that they want. But you're right. I mean, I would probably read something cold.
Yeah, maybe I would too. At least right here, right at the moment, I feel like I could use a little lake breeze because it's kind of on the warm and humid side. I don't know what it's like where you are.
Yeah, it is here too.
Yeah. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. There are a set of characters in here that you write about, and though the one that I was thinking of, the one that really you introduce first, and that a lot of people, even though, as I said, it's an ensemble piece, a lot of people grab onto, pick out, and a character that seems to really emerge, to really step forward, is a man named Roger Drinkwater, who lives on Lake Minneguesis, on the nice, what had been the nice side, but of course now is the less affluent side. A guy who likes the lake and likes living there and likes to swim, and has become increasingly annoyed with the lifestyles of the rich and famous, the people who live on the Indian side of the lake, particularly the kids who like to buzz around on the lake on jet skis. Tell us about Roger Drinkwater.
Well, Roger Drinkwater is a 7/8 Ojibwe or Chippewa and 1/8 Pole, Navy SEAL from the Vietnam era. He has a number of hats in the community. He's the swim coach and that sort of thing. And he is one of the last of his people on the lake. He has some issues with loud noises that have to do, you learn, from Vietnam, but not in a way that you would think. And he also has an underwater demolition background, which becomes very important later on.
Now there's foreshadowing for you.
And I think right there, that's why everyone loves him. Roger, it's funny. Early on, women started telling me that, like, Roger Drinkwater is really sexy. And early on, just reading it in a manuscript, and I thought, really? And then recently I just saw online on iVillage a Good Housekeeping column, some Good Housekeeping book review thing, and it was for two women write it about literary hunks, and they were talking about Roger Drinkwater as this guy that you're going to want to read about. I didn't know that I slipped some romance novel character in there, but that's fine. That's great. Maybe Johnny Depp will play him. I don't know.
Well, I think that the appeal of a character like that is that they are such strong individuals, and that they're bucking trends that, you know, maybe everybody else would like to. You'd like to do that, but you know you can't. You can't do what you can't take out after. You know, use your underwater demolition experience and taking out after people who are bothering you with their jet skis on what had been a previously peaceful lake. So maybe that's we're living vicariously a little bit through a character like that.
Yeah, I think having a firm sense of yourself is always a very attractive and intriguing characteristic.
Yeah.
Even though he does have some faults. Hey, David, I could read that opening paragraph if you wanted.
Yeah, sure, that'd be great.
It's from the first chapter. There was a heavenly time, a sliver-thin window of peace that Roger Drinkwater cherished every year on Minnegeesis. Those early days when the water warmed just enough for him to bear, but all others steered clear, and he could swim in peace and hear nothing but the water and his breath and the birds and the distant road, the way it had once been on this lake. It was a time before jet skis, before the idiot boys on their idiot toys, as he thought of them in the little sing-song chant that drummed in his head the rest of each summer.
He is a great character, and it's interesting that I was talking here with Martha, who you talked with before we went on.
Right.
And it does make me wonder a little bit. I don't know if this is too writerly kind of thing to ask, but, you know, sometimes in books there are characters that seem so real that you feel that you've met them before or you know someone like them. And then there are characters that are kind of only the kind of people that you meet in novels. And there are actually some of both of those kind of people, I think, in The Lake, the River, and the Other Lake. And in some ways, my reaction to Roger is that he is kind of like only a character that you would meet in a novel. And I wonder, as a writer, how you think about balancing those two things as you create characters, and whether you, on the one hand, have some sort of feeling like you'd like to invest people with enough reality so that readers can identify with them as real people. That, on the other hand, that you want to make characters that are memorable and that will serve your story and that people will enjoy, and the issue of whether or not they could actually be real, that's not important. I mean, I wonder if you think about those two things as you think about character.
Well, before I answer that, I want to say that I may call you as a witness if there are any explosions on my lake. that's totally fictional. Yeah, the interest in explosions is that's the only autobiographical thing there. I think that I don't know how overtly I think about that, but it seems to me that I usually start with the real specific thing that I can access myself. And in this case, it's just really I've had it with the jet skis.
Hmm.
And then you go into research and you find out about, stuff about Vietnam and about the Ojibwe culture and that kind of thing. But you start with something that is real that you can hang your hat on. I just don't know how conscious it is at this point, that idea of balancing it. I mean, it must be, but I know when something doesn't sound real or doesn't sound right, you know, it'll make me queasy.
Mm-hmm.
So, but whether or not I'm always, you know, it's not really in the forefront. It's just something that you kind of, it's a little odometer, a little gyroscope or something.
So let's go back to this underwater explosions. Now you don't have any they say you should, you know, write what you know. You don't have any personal experience with such a thing, or?
Oh no.
No. Okay. This is just all sort of, you know, wish fulfillment kind of stuff.
No, the closest I get is sort of amateur pyrotechnics. But yeah, it was interesting. Look, you know, double checking some recipes and things for this that I really had this feeling of, okay, wait, I'm a writer, and I have a, you know, constitutional right to access information and all this stuff, but I did hesitate when I was double checking and doing the fact checking part and really trying to, you know, look up stuff and even just looking at websites and taking books out in the library. I started to feel, you know, does somebody notice that I'm looking up a lot of stuff about explosives and stuff? And, I mean, that sort of gets to the idea that this takes place in 2001 in the summer, and it became that, it became fixed in 2001 when 9/11 happened, because I logistically couldn't figure out how this stuff would be happening without the FBI just swooping right in. Prior to that, post that.
That was, I think, one of the things that I read, that you had started writing the book earlier, and then when 9/11 came along, that you just got knocked off kilter, and it took you a while before you could come back and start working on it again.
Yeah, I was actually encouraged by the woman that ended up being my editor, Deborah Garrison, who's an amazing editor and poet. She's edited bunch of amazing books, like Three Junes and other books that haven't won the National Book Award, but you know, just does amazing stuff. And she was just talking to me as a friend, didn't know anything about the book, and she encouraged me. She said, I was feeling in general about writing that, you know, as a writer, and especially as a struggling writer, I felt kind of foolish pursuing, as I think a lot of people did right after that, pursuing something that felt self-centered or self-involved, and not going out and doing something else like fighting fires or something. And she's the one who said, no, even more than ever we need writers, and especially, you know, humorous writers. And then I did start to think, okay, well, maybe it fits in with this theme of the end of something, that this is a community in flux. There's definite change going on here. And this is the last summer. This is really the last summer. The last time there was this kind of free, open feeling. And at least that's how I felt at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that 9/11 is really present there, because, I don't know, I think it's the unspoken thing in the room in this book. And I did write a large body of it just a week or two before 9/11. And in August, I wrote, up at the cottage, I wrote the first, not the first 200 pages, but I wrote 200 pages of it in 10 days, 20 pages a day, which was probably a sign of insanity, and I probably should have seen somebody. But I had a large, you know, body of it done, and then 9/11 happened, and I had to put it away for a little bit.
Well, it does, now that you mention it, I guess that it does really. There are a lot of people in the book that in their own lives and what's going on are confronting some major turning point, some major change, or at least it's something that seems to them that, again, that they are confronting something. Like there's a retired minister who is still grieving over the loss of his wife. And there's a guy who was a kid who's a dot-com billionaire who's trying to figure out what he's going to do next.
Right.
And there's a man who has a family orchard who suddenly finds that one of his children, a son, has fallen in love with and married a young Latina woman who was a migrant farm worker, and his daughter has taken a shine to a Japanese botanist who's come over to study the cherry trees, and this happens virtually overnight. This happens to him, and he's dealing with the shock of that.
When the fiancé shows up with the migrant crew, Vaughn makes note of the fact that up until 5 minutes ago, up like breakfast time, he would have sworn his son was gay.
Yeah.
So it's quite a flip-flop.
Everybody's, it seems like a lot of these people are dealing with some sort of major jolt or shift or turn that suddenly something has happened, and suddenly that they feel that nothing is really quite like what it was, and there's this mixture of, you know, the longing for what was and the kind of apprehension or uncertainty about what comes next.
Yeah, and really, I mean, historically, if you start the historical opening, I just thought of this just now, but I mean, that's an invasion. That's the beginning of people coming in and changing this little tribal community that had never seen Europeans. And the stuff about the lighthouse, which you haven't gotten to, I think, what ultimately happens there, it feels, other readers have told me at readings that feels very echoey of 9/11. So, but in a funny way.
Yeah, folks. So don't, we're not trying to bring you down. So if you're looking for some entertainment, it's okay. You can look for the book. We have a caller here. We have a couple of callers. And also I should introduce again our guest, Steve Amick. His new novel, his first novel, is The Lake, the River, and the Other Lake. It's a mostly comic novel, which is set in Michigan in the fictional town of Winneshkeen, which is the site of the Lake Minnegesis, and the Ojon River that connects the lake, that lake, with the other lake, the big lake, that one being Lake Michigan. It's a lot of fun. So if you're interested in something kind of summary to read, that would be a good thing to take a look at. I'm sure you can find it out in the bookstore. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a couple callers here. We'll start with someone in Kankakee on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Your caller, being descended from pioneers who settled in his county at the beginning of it, is a local in his city. But it's not a city of locals and summer people. Of course, every place has a sense of place. Today, you're on the air in Illinois, the other side of the lake, and that makes a difference. An old name for Lake Michigan is Lake Illinois. In the book, Van Bushberger tunes into Detroit baseball, to the Chicago baseball, because he's in Michigan. And in the book, it's related that Michigan is Ojibwe for Great Lake, thereby making Lake Michigan Lake Great Lake. But your caller wonders about that place which is in the Michigan coast of Lake Michigan as a distant part of the Chicago, Illinois region. Our local newspaper, the Kankakee Daily Journal, is a part of the small newspaper group which produces Lake Magazine. And the Michigan shore is Chicago's playground. What do you say about the Gold Coast, Chicago connection? Thank you.
Well, can you talk about that?
David, could you help me sum that up?
Well, I guess I'm thinking of it. Well, for example, the caller mentions the fact that there is this incident in the book where where Vaughn Bushberger and the new additions to his family are sitting around and they're listening to a ball game and he's listening to Detroit.
Yeah, Ernie Harwell. Yeah,
the Tigers, and maybe it's the reception a little fuzzy, and so this Japanese botanist who now apparently is going to marry his daughter, says something like, well, you know, you're much closer to Chicago than you are to Detroit, so why not listen to some Chicago baseball game? And Vaughn, you know, this is just not on the program, that he couldn't possibly, because he's a Michiganer, and he says something like, well, you know, Detroit might be a dirty, crummy city, but it's in Michigan. We are not going to be, you know, the Cubs and the Sox notwithstanding, we are not going to listen to a Chicago baseball game. We are going to listen to the Detroit game because we are in Michigan. I'm sure, though, that there are a lot of people from the Chicago area who come up there who feel somewhat possessive about Lake Michigan and who maybe go up into that part of Michigan, the Gold Coast of where the Michigan, that it's the state of Michigan along Lake Michigan, where people are from Illinois are coming up there. And I guess it does raise some questions about feeling of possession, like whose lake is it? And particularly, is there a rivalry between Michigan and Illinois, and or between people who are Michigan people and Illinois people who go up there and are some of the summer people?
Well, I think that that's more pronounced down, a little further down. So if you go like from Muskegon down to the like Michigan City, Benton Harbor, Saugatuck maybe, but I'm not as familiar with that area, but I could see that is much closer to Chicago, and that has always been a Chicago thing. Historically, there were those ferry lines that meant that 100 years ago, even up in Petoskey and up north, those areas were heavily Chicago people coming for the summer. Petoskey is almost totally formed from that. Hemingway, for example, as a kid, going up to Horton Bay, was a Chicago summer person. And I don't know if I'm answering this question, but... it is strange and arbitrary to feel that way about the Tigers when you're on that side of the lake.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I've spent just a little time in the Door Peninsula of Wisconsin on the other side of the lake, and I think it's probably the same kind of deal, because I know a lot of people from Chicago drive up there, and they go on. It's close enough so that if you just wanted to go for the weekend, you could do that. Or you could spend substantial amounts of the summer, and there are a lot of really nice cottages and places like that, and it's very touristy and it's very arty, and I can imagine that it's kind of the same sort of thing. It's just the other side of the big lake.
Yeah, and I think if the ferry lines were back, I know they brought back another one, but I think that would change the dynamic. I mean, obviously, there'd be more access straight across. The other weird thing with that sports stuff is, of course, in the UP, which is part of Michigan, whether or not they want to admit that, everywhere you see, it's Green Bay Packers.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You know, they will have nothing to do with Detroit.
Mm. Let's talk with someone else here, calling from the campus. It's line number one. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just was curious, given this wonderful novel you've written, will you continue to return to your present summer home, or, though they're vast or quickly disappearing, look for the next quiet place? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
I think that eventually I may want to live in the UP and then come down to the summer home so that the summer home would be noisier than my regular home, in theory, but then you could have the peaceful nature area, still have the beautiful lake, even though it's very overrun and loud. Right now I live in Ann Arbor because my parents are getting on in age, and I think they need to have I'd like one of my siblings, including myself, I'd like someone to be here. So I live here, and it's nice to see my parents. But, yeah, I could see doing the opposite, having the winter retreat kind of thing, and then maybe dealing with lots of people in the summer.
Yeah. Well, we're here for about, with our guest Steve Emick, for about another 7-8 minutes. I mentioned earlier that you were, in addition to being a writer, you were a musician, and that there was a kind of a sampler CD of some music, some of your music, and also other people who were musicians, Michigan musicians who were friends of yours, and right. that some of these, some of the themes in these songs do tie in kind of with life in Winneshkeen. And I was kind of thinking we might play a cutoff here, and I was thinking about playing a song called I Feel Sorry for You If You Don't Live Here. And maybe you want to say a couple things about the song?
Yeah, I think it probably initially it was sparked when I was first went out east for undergrad, and this is 20 years ago. But, you know, started hearing weird perceptions about Michigan. For some reason, people thought, you know, Indians running around wild, and for some reason, corn. I don't know, but just a lot. So I took all the sort of stereotypical things about Michigan and turned it into sort of a yeah, that's right, we have that kind of a attitude.
Okay, well, let's listen to it again. This is our guest Steve Emick. The song "I Feel Sorry for You If You Don't Live Here."
You don't know. You've been missing. You've never been to Michigan.
It's true what they say. The streets are paved with rhubarb, and you can major in ice fishing. And by the age of 4, according to the law, you gotta know how to cross country ski. But if you like cherry pie, you're in luck, 'cause everyone's got the world's best recipe. And I feel sorry for you if you don't live here.
Sorry.
I feel so sorry for you. And everyone drinks Verner's and quotes Ring Lardner and goes bow hunting with the Nooch. And the second biggest sport in every high school is football right after luge. And every woman over, say, 45 knew Ricky Pop when his name was Jane. And everybody from that time who's still alive knew Patti Smith when she was a strain. And I feel sorry for you if you don't live here.
Sorry.
I feel so
sorry for you.
That's a little sampling of our guest Steve Emick and the song I Feel Sorry for You If You Don't Live Here, which is a compilation of songs that some of his music and some of his friends who are Michigan songwriters and all one way or another kind of connect to life in Michigan and some of the themes in his novel, The Lake, the River, and the Other Lake. One of the things that I wanted to have you talk a little bit about, because I think it's also, you know, we talked about some of the themes in the book. One of the themes and the things that it's all about is sense of place and connection with the place. But certainly one of the things that's it's also about is the strange kind of connections that can form between people and how people are attracted to one another. And I was really struck by a nice little paragraph and from an unlikely sort of character. As I mentioned in the book, there are the two lakes. There's Lake Michigan and there's Lake Munigasis. And in between, there's a river. And there are people who have boats on the lake, on the little lake, who go back and forth between the two. And you have to have a river pilot with you when you go down the river to make sure you don't run aground or run into anything. So one of the characters in the book is a young teenager who gets a job as an underpilot, and one of the more senior pilots, they're sitting around and having a beer, and he's talking about how people, you know, connect with each other sexually and otherwise. He says, there's no controlling who stirs who up, is there? What good would approving or not approving do? You never know who's going to stop you cold all of a sudden, stick their hand in your gut and twist it into a knot just by looking at you in a certain way, even if it's maybe the 100th time they've looked at you. That one time it's different, and then you're in, you're screwed. How true. I like that a lot. And that seems that that's also one of the things that you're interested in with the book and playing with in the story, is how people just grab one another, literally and metaphorically, and how it's just something that you never can predict.
Yeah, and not necessarily romantically, as he's talking about, but I realized, I don't know when, but I've realized at one point that the thing that I'm really drawn to in stories and movies and everything, and it sounds really hokey, but it's that point where characters make friends. I mean, the corniest version is a buddy movie, but I thought about it when I saw the movie. It really crystallized for me when I saw the movie Best Years of Our Lives years ago, and I thought, I love this moment when they all, these disparate characters that are soldiers that were on transport plane earlier in the opening, come into a bar and run into each other, and the guy who didn't know the guy before says, "Hey, did you see your girl?" And that moment, I just thought, like, I love the fact that he now knows this guy has got a sweetheart he has to get back to, and that he's lost his arms, and he's worried about it. And I love that moment, and I think we're really, as human beings, really attracted to that, to seeing that as well as feeling it, but seeing that moment when people connect. And often when they're just bumping into each other normally, and then they somehow make a connection. And it seems really simple and all that, but I think that's a key thing for us.
Yeah. Well, we're at the point where we're going to have to stop.
Okay.
I just want to, again, say it's a fun read, and if people are looking for something and entertaining here that might have a summer sort of a spirit to it, it would be a good thing for them to check out. The Lake, the River, and the Other Lake by our guest, Steve Amick. The book is published by Pantheon. Steve, I want to say thanks very much for taking some of your time and talking with us.
Thank you very much, David.
And there will be you're now working on a second book, which you don't want to talk about? Is that right?
I can tell you that it somehow involves Danish modern furniture. I can give you a longer version, but that'll be give time.
Oh, okay. Danish modern furniture. Well, look forward to that, and maybe we can talk again. So,
okay.
So again, thanks very much.
All right, bye.
Our guest, Steve Amick, and again, the book published by Pantheon. It's out now in the bookstore, The Lake, the River, and the Other Lake. Programs here on WILL are made possible in part by the 3rd Annual Sugar Creek Symphony and Song Opera and Classical Music Festival from August 5th through the 7th in Watseka, Illinois. The festival will feature a production of the comic opera Cinderella by Rossini, a Saturday evening symphony, and daytime activities. More information is available at the website www.sugarcreekfestival.org. Programming also made possible by Strawberry Fields. In downtown Urbana, Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655. We're going to break for news and update on the markets. We'll be back.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4665.